So we've been exploring during these talks what are called the seven factors of awakening, also known as the seven treasures or the seven friends or the Satabhojangas. These seven profound qualities of mind and heart are considered treasures because when we use our practice to cultivate them, the teachings tell us that these eventually lead us to awakening itself. So they're really important, they're treasures. You might also recall that as we practice, these qualities of mind and heart tend to flow in a kind of progression, with each factor supporting the development of the next one. And so we've already explored the first three of these factors, which is a summary, our mindfulness. We start with mindfulness. Can't have a mindfulness practice without mindfulness. Mindfulness is sati, S-A-T-I, which leads into investigation, vikaya, which then leads into energy, which is virya. And tonight, we're on one of my favorite factors, the fourth, which is pitti, which is P-I-T-I. And this one is another one of those Pali words that's really difficult to translate into English. And so it's often been referred to as rapture, or joy, happiness, delight, rapt attention, or bliss. And one of the descriptions I love, it's often called or simply referred to as Dharma joy, Dharma joy. And, you know, so often when people think of the Buddhist teachings, they tend to mistake the instructions for us to take an honest, naked look at our suffering to mean that the whole practice is simply about leaning into the suffering and that it just ends there, right? Or, you know, especially in the beginning, maybe even for years, a lot of people think that if we aren't somehow somber or really serious or maybe even grim enough, you know, that we aren't really practicing right. So it's so helpful to remember that in the last two of the famous Four Noble Truths, the Buddha assures us that there is a way out, thankfully, of our suffering. And this involves training our minds and hearts to discover more happiness and freedom. That's what we're doing. In fact, the Buddha himself was known as the happy one. I like to remember that. Buddha was known as the happy one. The great monk Nanapinka Thera said this about piti to a group of monks. Said, life, though full of woe, holds also sources of happiness and joy unbeknownst to most. Let us teach people to seek and find real joy within themselves and to rejoice with the joy of others. Let us teach them to unfold their joy to even sublimer heights. Noble and sublime joy is not foreign to the teachings of the Enlightened One. Wrongly, the Buddha's teachings is sometimes considered to be a doctrine diffusing melancholy. Far from it, the Dharma leads step by step to an ever purer and loftier happiness. I really like that. So, of course, even though we really do want to take a good hard look at all the ways that we create suffering for ourselves and others so that we can root these out. The truth is that if we don't eventually discover any joy or happiness in our practice, we're not going to continue it for very long, are we? Let alone a lifetime. It is also true that without a sense of joy, our practice itself isn't likely to lead us anywhere that's going to be useful to ourselves or others. Really helpful to remember. This quality of joy is so important, actually, that it is considered the bridge between the other six factors. It's what gets us to the other side. So it's exactly, actually, what we need in order to cross over from the more, what are considered the more energizing factors of mindfulness and investigation and energy, those first three, into the more calming and peaceful factors, which we'll get to later, which are tranquility and concentration and equanimity, which you'll recall is the fruit of our practice. So piti, joy, is what connects them. One of my teachers, James Perez, who wrote an excellent book, if you're ever interested in reading, is Awakening Joy, says this about piti. As one of the seven factors of enlightenment, joy is not only a fruit of awakening, but also a prerequisite. Joy creates spaciousness in the mind that allows us to hold the suffering we experience inside us and around us without becoming overwhelmed, without collapsing into helplessness or despair. It brings inspiration and vitality, dispelling confusion and fear while connecting us with life. Profound understanding of suffering does not preclude awakening to joy. Indeed, it can inspire us all the more to celebrate joyfully the goodness in life. So just for a moment, if you will, I'm going to invite you to close your eyes just for a moment. Just for a moment. And just reflect on this quality of piti and what these words mean to you, or maybe even how you feel when you hear these words as I repeat them. Really tap into the heart here. Joy. And if it's helpful, you can even place a hand or two on the heart. Just listen. Joy. Happiness. Delight. Rapt interest. Rapture, bliss, Dharma joy. I'm going to repeat them again. Joy, happiness, delight. Rapt interest, rapture, bliss, Dharma joy, so you can go ahead and open the eyes. I know that was really brief, but you know, for me, whenever those words are said, they almost always seem to just make me breathe a little deeper, relax my shoulder a bit, almost like I'm experiencing just a little taste of it right in the moment, right? Anybody else have that hearing the words? And also, I always feel a real longing for it. You get a sense of that too? I long for that, right? Joy, happiness, delight, rapt interest, bliss. Dharma joy. So piti is said to have this quality of refreshing and delighting the mind, like a cool breeze on a hot day. And happily for us in our practice, we can experience all kinds of different joy and rapture for various periods of time. So for instance, we can experience piti very momentarily, really quickly, or it can last a really long time on longer periods of retreat. And our experience of piti can be either really subtle or sometimes very intense. Intense sometimes almost to the point of pain, some people say. So during our practice, for instance, we might feel piti in specific areas of our bodies. So maybe at the top of the head, or maybe right at the center of the chest, like an expanding. Other times it might feel like the whole body is expanding, like we're becoming taller or bigger than we are. Anybody have that in practice? It's kind of fun, right? Or it can feel like a sense of joy and relief through the whole body. And the Buddha actually categorized these experiences into different levels. So there's minor rapture. Isn't that funny? There's minor rapture, which you may have already experienced. So this is when we feel like we can hold our posture almost effortlessly. We're not struggling so much. Then there's a momentary rapture, which can feel like sometimes a sudden jolt of energy, or like a flash of lightning, or maybe like a sudden drop sometimes, like when you're in an elevator drop, like a sudden drop. Then there's wave-like or showering rapture, which is exactly what it sounds like. It feels like waves in the body or a shower of rapture. There is uplifting rapture, which can feel like you're floating. Anybody have that? Feel like they're floating in practice? And finally, there is pervading rapture, which the great monk Mahasi Sayadaw describes as a sublime feeling of happiness and exhilaration, filling the whole body with an exceedingly sweet and subtle thrill. Now, he's a monk, so he probably gets this often, but for the rest of us, I don't know. So, you know, all of this can be real motivation for us. It's a real, really one of the beautiful gifts of the practice. Even so, you know, as with all of the many interesting things that we might experience during our formal practice, my question is always and forever, so what? Why do I want to experience any of this, really? Why? What's the point? You know, how is this leading me towards enlightenment or to the end of suffering? Because that's what I want. I don't care about minor rapture. I want permanent rapture, right? I want nirvana. You guys with me? Yeah. So with pity, what's less important is the feeling of it, and what is absolutely more important is how we get there. What creates this experience of pity? And the paradox is that in order for us to actually create this bridge for ourselves and truly experience piti, what we need to learn to do is to let go, right? And, of course, what we're learning to let go of are all the ways we habitually try to create joy and happiness for ourselves, which unfortunately just tends to create much more dukkha for us, much more disappointment and pain and suffering, right? So, for instance, we might start to notice that so often what we're really seeking in our daily lives are ways to make the body and even our egos or sense of self feel more comfortable, aren't we? So as a practice, we might even start to notice our tendency to want to enjoy only pleasant things, only pleasant tastes, touches, smells, sounds, sights, right? And as a practice, we might even start to notice that. We can notice also when we don't experience pleasant sights, smell, taste, sounds, which is how often a day? Every minute? Every second? Right? And when we don't want this, we tend to get frustrated or aversive, and therefore we suffer. We also tend to want to have only things that are going to make our egos feel pleasant, right? So for instance, we might think that what would really make us happy is more praise, less judgment, less blame, less insult. If we could just surround ourselves with people who liked us and praised us and who were consistently pleasant to be around, and oh, by the way, who also agreed with us how life should be, my God, we'd be so happy, wouldn't we? Darn it. And speaking of our egos and comfort, you know, we might also think that if we only had more stuff, if only I had a bigger house or more money or maybe more prestige, more power in some way, you know, then we'd be happy. Or maybe if everyone and everything would just stop endlessly shifting and changing and just be and stay the way we wanted it, then we would be consistently happy. Stop changing, right? And of course, we also tend to want the things that we cherish to stay here forever, You know, this includes all of our stuff, all of our possessions, all the things we own, and, you know, most importantly, our loved ones, and especially ourselves, right? We want to stay here forever. FYI. Right? And when we're expecting all of the pleasant things or situations or people in our lives to make and then keep us happy, guess what? We're going to suffer. And this is because, again, all of these things are imperfect, and they're also impermanent. We cannot control or hold on to any of it, you know, including this life. And our trying to do so, our trying to control and cling to everything, is one of, if not the main ways that we create suffering for ourselves. I love this quote from the Scottish poet Robert Burns, or it's a line. Pleasures are like poppies spread. You seize the flower, its bloom is shed. Or like the snowfall in the river, a moment white, then melts forever. So it's important for us to understand, really important, that pity is not something that's created through pleasant contact with the senses or by satisfying the ego in some way or even striving for this, okay? Pity is a kind of spiritual happiness that arises when we have become practiced in those first three factors. When we've established a practice of mindfulness and investigation and energy, and when we've started to let go of a sense of me and mine, when we've stopped taking everything so personally, right? And when the practice itself starts to become more and more focused, we can finally start seeing things much more clearly. The great Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh tells us this. When we're caught in a belief that happiness should take a particular form, we fail to see the opportunities for joy that are right in front of us. Okay. So even though this quality of piti arises almost naturally from our practice and from developing those first three factors and from learning to let go, the happy news is that it's also something that we can actively cultivate, okay? So we can very consciously set up the right conditions for Dharma joy to arise, remembering that piti, like all things, is also fleeting, you know, and isn't something that we can hold on to, right? Or even strive for, actually, which is a paradox. We can't strive for it. We can cultivate the conditions for it. And we definitely don't want to identify with piti as self, right? As something that's either going to inflate our ego when we experience it, or maybe deflate our ego, you know, when we don't, right? We're simply working on setting up the conditions for it to arise. So, as you might imagine, then the first three of these conditions that we can set up for ourselves are those first three factors of awakening, all of which, if we really investigate, include a sense of joy. And we can use our practice to notice this, the joy in those first three factors. So let me explain that. So, for instance, we might start to notice the joy that comes with mindfulness, that first factor, with a more sustained sense of being present right here with whatever we're experiencing, even if it's unpleasant. Isn't there? There's a kind of joy in being awake to it rather than away from our bodies, not here. Isn't there? Right? There's that joy. There's also a joy that comes from investigation, the second factor, which is paying close attention or being interested in something. So when we're really investigating the body or our breath or our mind, Isn't there kind of a joy that comes with that when you're really with it, right? We also experience a sense of joy when we can sense the energy that we're giving to our practice, when we feel in some way motivated to continue or have that sense of deep commitment. Isn't there a joy to that? Committed to my practice, more committed. There's joy in energy. Once we've established ourselves in these first three factors, we then discover even another joy as we begin to have deeper understandings of the practice on a much more experiential level instead of a purely intellectual one. So these deeper understandings arise more and more as we start to really embody the practice rather than simply think about the practice. There can be a profound sense of joy in the sense of, I'm no longer being told something. I actually now know something for myself through my own practice and experience. Hallelujah, right? There's joy in that. Joy can also arise as we experience more and more of what are called the aha moments, when we're able to finally look behind a particular curtain, if you will, and more clearly see our dukkha and what causes it, right? This can be really exciting, right? Even if it's also really painful. It's like it can be a great relief and delight to finally see, you know, how we're creating suffering for ourselves and for others through our own ancient conditioned beliefs and habits of relating to life. And, you know, maybe most importantly with this, there's also a real sense of joy and, again, relief when we can see these things, these conditions, without also making it about self. When we can see that these beliefs and behaviors are conditioned, not me, right? Not me. And, of course, this is when we are starting to realize more and more the joy of anatta, no self, the truth of no self, the truth that we ourselves do not have a permanent, solid identity, that we don't need to take everything so personally. It's like, again, hooray, hallelujah, it's not just me, and it's not all about me, right? So this realization of anatta connects us to another profound joy, which is a deep heart-centered recognition that, hey, I belong. If it's not about me, I belong, I'm connected, I'm not alone. You know, what a relief. And this one, in fact, might create the most profound joy, because as the teachings show us, the source of our greatest suffering is a sense of not belonging. It's a source of our greatest suffering, feeling disconnected from the whole in some way. Think, isn't it? Think about that, right? Which leads to another joy, which is when we can also start to glimpse again more experientially the truth of anicca, impermanence. The truth that there's really nothing to hold on to. Nothing to hold on to. And instead of this feeling scary, maybe terrifying, right? As we continue to practice, this realization starts to just feel even more liberating. There's nothing to hold on to. So there's a real joy when we begin to truly know for ourselves what are called the three truths or characteristics of life, which is that life is impermanent, anicca. It's imperfect. We all experience dukkha, suffering, pain. And it's also impersonal. It's not just about me. We are all connected. Life is impermanent, imperfect, and impersonal. So another way that we can create the conditions for PT is by very consciously cultivating what are considered the more wholesome states of mind and heart. which are qualities like generosity and kindness and compassion and mudita, happiness for others. These beautiful states of mind and heart are considered wholesome because they are free of what are called the three poisons. A lot of lists here. But they're free of what are called the three poisons: greed, ill will, and delusion. And I like to, it helps me to consider the three poisons often as like three really strong types of alcohol. And consider what it feels like when our minds are free of these, when the mind is clear and awake and concentrated and sober, right? Isn't the mind so much more joyful this way, right? When we're not poisoned by greed and anger, ill will, delusion, we're not drunk on that. And really consider this for a moment. How does the mind feel, truly, when it's filled with compassion or kindness or generosity? You know? And how does it feel when it's clouded or poisoned again with greed or wanting, hatred, ill will, delusion, an inflated focus or grip on self? It's not very pleasant, is it? It's not very joyful. So this experience of piti is said to be joyful precisely because it is lacking in the three poisons. It's absent of greed, aversion, delusion, which are really umbrella categories for all the different unwholesome states that cause us to suffer and struggle. In the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha tells us this: gladness connected with the wholesome I call an equipment of the mind, an equipment for developing a mind that is without hostility and ill will. So the Buddha is giving us a tool here: gladness connected with the wholesome, and telling us that we can use it like a piece of equipment, right? Like a surgeon's medical instrument, maybe, to cut out all those states of mind and heart that cause us to struggle. Gladness connected with the wholesome. So along with our cultivation of those first three factors of awakening, mindfulness, investigation, and energy, which includes working to cultivate the more wholesome qualities and weeding out the unwholesome ones, there are also many different things that we can reflect on in our practice that can help us to cultivate or strengthen our experience of PT even more, okay? And tonight I want to offer you just three of the most profound of these reflections that we can use to strengthen our joy. And the first, and maybe most effective of these, is to reflect on our virtue, our ethical conduct, our sense of integrity, our commitment to refrain ourselves from doing harm to ourselves or others. And isn't this what we need right now, it feels like, in our world, right? So in Pali, our practice of ethical conduct is called sila, S-I-L-A, and it is one of the three core principles or branches of the teachings: ethics, sila, concentration, samadhi, and wisdom, which is panna, those three. So sila, or ethical conduct and practice, is something we are asked to constantly, consistently do, even when it feels incredibly difficult, which it most often is. It's difficult, isn't it? It's not easy to do the right thing all the time, is it? If it were, I would suspect the world would be a much different place if it were really easy to do. So it's a practice. And yet, the truth is, if we really start to use our practice of investigation, we might notice that doing something unethical or without restraint almost always leaves a trace of pain for ourselves or others, doesn't it? It leaves a trace of pain. And, on the other hand, doing the right thing or restraining ourselves from doing harm almost always leaves a trace of joy, doesn't it? Leaves it, think about that, like something to contemplate. The great monk Ajahn Sumedho tells us, once you have insight, then you find you enjoy and delight in the beauty and goodness of things. Truth, beauty, and goodness delight us. In them, we find joy. The Buddha actually called our practice of integrity the bliss of blamelessness. The bliss of blamelessness. And if you think about it, when our minds are not filled with regret, aren't they so much more joyful? When the mind is not filled with regret, the bliss of blamelessness. The other good news about practicing sila is that the more we start to notice how good it feels to live a life that's committed to non-harming and to restraint, what happens is that we end up strengthening this quality because we can sense more and more the joy and the freedom that comes from it. In the Dhammapada, which is an ancient, very beloved collection of the core teachings of the Buddha, which were memorized and chanted by the monastics for thousands of years, there are several teachings that really relate to how we achieve this quality of piti through our ethical conduct. And there were two of them that I wanted to share. I couldn't pick just one because I liked them both. And I'll share these. The first one is that one who does evil grieves in this life, grieves in the next, grieves in both worlds. Seeing one's own defiled acts brings grief and affliction. One who makes merit rejoices in this life, rejoices in the next, rejoices in both worlds. Seeing one's own pure acts brings joy and delight. And the second one is, glory grows for a person who is energetic and mindful, pure and considerate in action, restrained and vigilant, and who lives in the Dharma. Through effort, vigilance, restraint, and self-control, the wise person can become an island no flood will overwhelm. Unwise, foolish people give themselves over to negligence. The wise protect vigilance as the greatest treasure. Do not give yourself to negligence. Do not devote yourself to sensual pleasure. Vigilant and absorbed in meditation, one attains abundant happiness. Okay. Another very traditional way that we can strengthen our joy or piti is by reflecting on what are considered our various acts of generosity, or dana in Pali. And here you might recall that one of the main ways that we create suffering for ourselves is through clinging and grasping, our unwillingness to let go. And again, what we want to hold on to is just about everything, right? Material things, our finances, our opinions, our grudges, other people, you know, of course, most importantly, our strong sense of self. Just don't want to let go. And so just as we notice how good sila feels, we can also start to notice every time that we're generous in some way and really, truly consider how it feels in the mind and the body and the heart, okay? When we're willing to let go, maybe of our grudges or opinions, etc. On the other hand, we can also notice what it feels like when we feel somehow unwilling or unable to let go. How does that feel? Investigate it. Really, sometimes when I'm holding on, just notice, how is this really helping me? How is this contributing to my joy and happiness and quality of life to continue to hold on this? And when we can begin to notice how bad it feels to hold on at various levels, what happens is that it just becomes that much easier to let go because we won't want to keep holding that burning coal in our hands, right? Why am I burning myself in this way? So a third traditional way that we can cultivate pitti is by inclining the mind towards it. We can cultivate a mind that is filled with a sense of peace and happiness, which we were working on this weekend on retreat, finding peace in the chaos. We can incline the mind towards that. And we can do this by very diligently investigating in every moment the state of our minds and noticing what's happening here, right? Am I allowing the mind to fall into fantasy or delusion? Am I chewing on some negative story or narrative or belief? Or am I nurturing some kind of negative emotion? Am I nurturing it? You know? And we can also actively, again, incline the mind towards a sense of joy and ease and peace. As the teachings show us, in order for us to discover peace, we first truly need to practice being peace, right? Really inclining the mind towards this. And of course, as a reminder, this never, ever, ever means that we're painting a smiley face over anything. We aren't overlooking the horrible things that happen in this life at all. What we're doing is very actively cultivating our wise, good hearts and noticing in each and every moment, or asking ourselves, how am I showing up for or relating to whatever's happening? So we can really ask ourselves things all day. Like, how am I meeting or greeting, relating to what are considered the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows? The full catastrophe of our lives, as Jon Kabat-Zinn would say. How are we meeting all of it? Am I showing up with greed or hatred or delusion? How am I showing up here? Right? Or am I showing up with kindness, forgiveness, compassion, joy, peace? You know, in the teachings, the Buddha tells us that not only is it possible to show up in our lives with a sense of joy and ease and peace, it's actually essential. It's essential. With all the sorrow and despair and hatred and delusion in this world, what we desperately need is people who can offer a sense of joy and peace and calm, not as a selfish thing at all, but as a kind of healing balm for everyone, desperately needed. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha urges us, live in joy, in love. Even among those who hate, live in joy, in health. Even among the afflicted, live in joy, in peace, even among the troubled. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way. So I think I want to end there and offer you a brief meditation to end. And so for this one, it's very short, so I really want to invite all of you to place one hand on the heart, one hand on the belly, or both hands on the heart, if that's okay. You don't have to, it's a suggestion. Really breathe into the fingers. Feel the body breathing. Maybe taking even a nice, long, deep breath in. Slow exhale, really tapping into the body and the mind and the heart. You might even place your attention simply on the inhale and exhale right at the nostrils. Just noticing the body breathing. You might even add a slight smile the corner of the eyes and the lips. Remembering that one of the definitions of piti is rapt attention. Rapt attention. You might use your practice to place your attention on the simple act of breathing, noticing all the nuances of breathing, just right here, the nostrils. You might sense the coolness on the inhale, and the warmth on the exhale. Noticing the texture of the breath and how that changes. And recalling with each inhale that this is a brand new moment of your life that you've been gifted. And you get to enjoy. Each exhale is an opportunity to practice letting go. So what I'd like to invite you to investigate is the joy that comes from simply being present to each moment, each breath. Can you find the joy in rapt attention? Even if it's just momentary, get a taste of that. And finally, with the eyes still closed, just listening to these words from Julia Fehrenbacher. Moment of noticing. After a few mindless moments of clicking, scrolling, scanning, body and mind are full, flooded with horrific, heartbreaking news. Burning Australia, koalas, kangaroos, people running for their lives. Cancer stealing breath from a treasured friend. More pettiness in politics. How far we travel in a single moment. I am an unwatered plant in need of sunlight and good news. In the next breath, I notice evening light has found bare oaks, has set them ablaze with beautiful. This moment of noticing brings me back to here, to the only place plants can be watered, the only place sun ever shines. hope you enjoyed this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to these teachings, and your support really makes a difference. Dana is an ancient Pali word meaning spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to offer Dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much.